the gist of it is that there will be less products regulated now than there were regulated before, and there'll be less transparency now than there were before. There were public comment periods, and interestingly, on the issue I've mentioned, on the self-determination of the exemptions, there was actually a lot of not just consumer groups and environmental groups who opposed that self-determination, but there was actually a lot of industry who objected to that self-determination. And in fact, my organization, with a number of consumer groups, and the biotechnology innovation organization, the Monsantos and the Syngentas of the world belong to that organization, they also opposed the self-determination, as well as some of the grain handlers, the Cargills of the world, for some of the transparency reasons that I talked about. The Trump administration did not meet our request.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
GMOs were in the news for years. If you were involved in the food industry, whether a consumer or a farmer, there was a lot of talk about GMOs. There were efforts to label GMOs. There's now marketing efforts that have non-GMOs in the stores, and there's people that, you know, have still continue to have concerns and interests. But again, it just hasn't been in the news that much. Well, I have a guest today who's been following this and very much engaged in genetic engineering on rules and proposals and regulations. And I'm just really happy to welcome Greg Jaffe. Greg is the biotech director with Center for Science and the Public Interest. Greg, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you.
Greg, some people would think that when you were working on biotech issues, because they haven't seen much in the news, that you might have been able to take it easy for the last several years. But I suspect you've got a different story to tell on that.
I mean, I think that this issue has continued to grow and evolve over the last few years. Maybe other people had some bigger fish to fry on other issues, and so it went a little lower on people's priority list, but this is still a hot topic.
Well, I mean, the hot topic was that probably, what was it now, 5, 7, 8 years ago, where there were so many movements on trying to label GMOs, because there were people that were very concerned about knowing whether or not the foods they were consuming were genetically engineered. And so there were several states that voted on requiring labeling of GMOs. And then there was finally some federal action that was addressing that. You were involved when that was taking place, were you not?
Yes, Roger, so I was. So you are correct that in the mid, around 2014, 2015, there were a number of state initiatives to try to get mandatory GMO labeling on foods, and some of those the state ballot initiatives did not pass in the states that they were, California and Washington and Oregon and Colorado. There were some state bills that did pass in Vermont and Connecticut and Maine, and in 2016 the Vermont law actually started into effect in July 1st of 2016, and that sparked Congress to get involved, because the food industry really doesn't like 50 states having different laws on a subject, because, you know, food manufacturers don't label their products or produce their food just for Vermont. They do it for many states in the area, and to the extent if there were additional laws that went into effect and they were different, how could they comply with those? And so there was a big push to have a national standard. And so Congress did get engaged and passed the National Bioengineered Disclosure Law in 2016, which President Obama signed.
I want to back up, though, back to when the states were proposing to come up with their own. What was behind that? Were these were the consumer groups? Who was it that started promoting the idea that there should be state actions requiring GMO labeling?
So I'm not sure I can answer that question as to who exactly was behind.
Oh, I don't mean who exactly, but I mean kind of was it. It showed up in several different states. So I guess the what I'm trying to get to was, why did anybody want to do that? Why was that a matter that some people felt consumers needed to know whether or not the food was genetically engineered?
Well, maybe we have to step back for a second and talk about what is a genetically modified organism.
Oh, do that.
What is a genetically modified food?
Yeah.
And so, you know, genetic engineering is a technology actually that's been around for a long time, but it is an opportunity for scientists to take a gene from one organism and put it into another organism. In most cases, for agricultural purposes, we're talking about putting something into a plant or an animal so that it gives a beneficial trait, a trait that normally wouldn't be found in that organism. And that trait would be beneficial in some way. It might make them resistant to a pest or a virus. It might add some nutritional quality. It might make it less browning or less bruising, so there'd be less food waste. It might make it have some higher nutritional trait, change the oil profile of a soybean, for example. And so scientists were developing genetically modified crops that had this, used this technique in the laboratory, where it's done at the cellular level, where you take a gene from one species and introduce it into another species. Because we know that all DNA is the same. All species have DNA, and all species read DNA the same way and produce proteins from that. And so it allowed people to take DNA from one organism and move it to another. So I think to some people that sounds scary, and to some people they didn't like that. It was done primarily in corn and soybeans. Those are big commodity crops, big industrial agriculture. Some people weren't pleased with the fact that this was another method of making our agriculture more industrialized, our food system more processed. And so there were some people, for whatever reason they had, who wanted to avoid foods that were made this way. And so there was an attempt to require labeling. And I think that a lot of other countries around the world have mandatory GMO labeling, and the United States didn't have that. There was attempts to do it at the national level, and those weren't being successful. And so people thought, well, let's try that at the state level. Let's see if we can get some laws passed to require labeling at the state level. As I said, for some states, it was done through state initiatives. And I think surprisingly to some, didn't pass. More than 50% of the people voted against that, having mandatory labeling in California, Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. I think people expected it would pass necessarily, but people didn't vote on it for whatever reason. But it did begin to pass in some state legislatures, and there were many bills introduced in other legislatures. I might also just point out that I think some people were concerned that these products might not be safe to eat. I think the evidence is overwhelming that there's been no evidence to date of any food safety or nutritional issues arising from genetically engineered crops and ingredients made from those crops. And that's been the conclusion of FDA, that's been the conclusion of the National Academy of Sciences and others. So while some people may want to know because they think that those are not safe, there has been no evidence to date that the products that are currently grown have any safety concerns.
You know, Greg, I was just thinking, it seems appropriate that the first name of your organization is Center, because you're kind of in the center of this whole issue. I mean, the Center for Science and the Public Interest is, I find you kind of in the middle of these discussions. I mean, there are people that are just total advocates of genetic engineering, GMOs, all this. And then there's some on the other extreme that are totally opposed. What I've seen of your view is that you see a place for it, and you were just saying there's no evidence of harm, but you've also always said there's a certain amount of oversight and a certain amount of regulations that's appropriate. So opposed to the two camps, for and against, I've always viewed your positioning as kind of like conditioned on, you know, like there's a caveat, you know, that – am I saying this correctly? I'm going to let you talk for yourself pretty soon here, but it just seems to me that you've always taken this position that yes, it can be very good, However, we do believe that there has to be a certain amount of oversight and regulations to be sure that it is continuing to meet the needs of the public in a safe manner.
So you mentioned my organization. So I'll take a different perspective on our name. It's the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And I think, you know, when we were started more than 50 years ago, we were started by several PhD scientists who really wanted to bring science into the advocacy and arena on behalf of consumers. And so, you know, we pride ourselves in making science-based advocacy and science-based education. So, and we primarily do that in the food and nutrition space. And that, of course, genetic engineering, genetically modified foods are in that space. So in our mind, we let the science dictate our positions. And so I think in the biotech arena, you are correct. We are not on the pro side or on the anti side. We look at the science and we look at it on a case by case basis. And so, as I said, we've looked at the science for the current crops, and the science has shown that there are no evidence of any food safety concerns from those. We've also seen that there have been some benefits from those products, depending on the product, some benefits to farmers or some benefits to the environment, not really a lot of benefits to consumers so far, but there also have been some impacts. And those products, while they could be used sustainably, haven't been used sustainably. And so we've seen development of resistant weeds and development of resistant pests and sort of overuse and misuse of those products in farmers' fields. So our view has been that there are potential risks from genetic engineering. There are some food safety potential risks. We could introduce a gene that produces a protein that's an allergen, and we don't want new allergens entering the food supply. Somebody who's allergic to something, that can be a life and death situation. And so we do need regulation to have an independent check to make sure, for example, that that new gene doesn't produce a protein that's an allergen. I mean, we want FDA to be involved. Similarly, we have issues that these crops can be used sustainably, but they also cannot be used sustainably. And we want agencies like EPA and USDA involved so that we can make sure we have proper risk assessments of these products and then proper risk management. Because if they are beneficial to society or to the environment or to farmers, we want those benefits to accrue for many, many, many years. We don't want them to be overused and abused. And then we go back to a more harmful chemical insecticide, for example, because some genetic engineered crops reduce the use of chemical insecticides for a more environmentally friendly biological pesticide. So our view has been we need to look at these case by case. We need to look at the science, and we need to have good policy and oversight to make sure that we can obtain the benefits, minimize the impacts and risks of this technology, which is not inherently dangerous, but can be used and be very successful.
So who does that? Which agencies are responsible to be sure that what's coming on board, or what new products are and so forth, are going through a certain process that the consumers can feel they've minimized the risk and they're taking that responsible position as an agency?
So there are three agencies that currently look at genetically modified or genetically engineered crops and animals. Depending on whether it's a crop, depending on whether an animal, you could have one, two, or three agencies looking at those. And we have the Food and Drug Administration, who's the primary agency that looks to make sure that our food supply is safe. And so they have a role in this. We have the Environmental Protection Agency, and they have a role because they deal with products like pesticides, and some of the genetically engineered crops produce their own biological pesticides. So they fall within their mandate. Also, some of the products are resistant or tolerant to herbicides, and EPA has a role because they're the ones who approve those herbicide use on top of the crops that are genetically engineered. And then USDA, they're sort of our agency department involved with agriculture, and they have some authorities to ensure that crops and that we don't develop pest issues, plant pest issues, or we don't develop resistant noxious weed issues. So they are involved also with these crops to make sure that they aren't going to harm, I'll say for a better term, agricultural interests in the United States.
So they kind of work as a committee, then somebody from each of those agencies?
So they know, I mean, each agency has its own legal authority from Congress. You know, the executive branch only does what Congress tells them to do, the legislative branch. So Congress passes laws and the executive branch implements those laws. And in this case, there are different laws for each of those agencies. And so depending on the product, we could have a genetically engineered crop, let's say, that could be reviewed by one, two, or three agencies. So for example, if we were talking about a genetically engineered bent grass, well, we don't eat bent grass, so there'd be no reason for FDA to get involved because there's no food safety, no food or feed component to that crop. Right. We also, if it doesn't have a pesticide involved with it, then EPA wouldn't be involved. And so we would only have USDA involved. So depending on the crop and the trait, we could have one, two, or three agencies that might be looking at a particular one, each having their own independent regulatory procedures and system based on the laws that they are looking at. However, we wouldn't, for those different agencies, they would coordinate with each other. They may share information, but in the end, Congress has given each one of them their individual decision-making power. So the government doesn't give one decision, they might give three decisions.
So if we decide that we're going to say it's a new potato, we're going to come up, there's been some potatoes that they've experimented with. And so we genetically engineer a new potato that bakes itself or something, I don't know what. But would the first place that we make a call, and we're going to have Greg and Roger's company, would we call the USDA and say, I got this new potato and we're going to want to produce it and take it to the market? Do you typically like go straight to some department in that agency to get the ball rolling?
So typically, and again, the rules have changed now somewhat up until May of 2020. If you were doing research in the laboratory, well, the only thing you needed to do was comply with the NIH guidelines if it was a federally funded project, assuming or an organization that gets federal funding. So if we were a company that didn't get any federal funding, then we wouldn't have to do that. But that would just be generally good laboratory practices. Where our first involvement with the government would be if we decided to have some field trials, so to test it outdoors. We're not so worried about these products. We're in the laboratory. They're not going to escape the laboratory. But when we start getting into fields, then we're out in the outdoors. We begin to worry. So historically, you would have gone to USDA to make sure that you could, how you would plant that to do our field trials, to test our crop. So if we had genetically engineered this potato, you and I, we would want to make sure that we could test it to see if it works in real world conditions. The fact that it worked in the laboratory wouldn't be successful. So we'd go through a series of tests and those would be overseen by USDA. Then if we then moved past those and we wanted to commercialize that product, depending on whether it had a pesticide associated with it, we might have to go to EPA. Otherwise we would just stay at USDA. And then depending on whether it's a food crop, we might go to FDA. Although I have to tell you that FDA's process is a voluntary process. So we could choose whether or not we wanted FDA to look at our safety data. We wouldn't be required to. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act requires us to ensure that our food is safe. It can't be adulterated, but it doesn't require FDA to get a pre-market approval of it before we put it on the market. FDA, however, has set up a voluntary consultation process, and most, if not all, of the biotech crops that are currently on the market have gone through that voluntary process where developers do submit data to the FDA to look at and see if there are any problems that FDA would see in the company's determination that they say this is a safe product for consumers to eat.
Greg, a few minutes ago, you mentioned that there were some changes that took place like after May 2020, which is, you know, we're in that famous year right now, and that there were some changes in the way that regulations were going to be go into effect. And you've made some comments about some of those changes. Could you explain what it is that's happened in the course of this last year in the changes in the regulations and some of the issues you're observing?
Sure. Well, you have to think about this as So our first genetically engineered crops went through the regulatory process, and farmers started growing them in 1996. Right. So we're talking about 25 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. And so agencies generally, you know, every once in a while try to revise their regulations. They learn, you know, after you've done something for 10 or 20 years, you learn what you've done, and sometimes you've been overly cautious and sometimes you've been overly permissive. And so you might adapt your regulations. And so USDA actually for about 10 years now has been trying to revise their regulations. They had said there was time for revision. And so, you know, I don't think anybody can be against revision. It's good to look and see where things could be done better, more efficient. As a taxpayer, I want the government to be as efficient as possible. I don't want them to be asking for unnecessary data or doing things that aren't needed. But similarly, I still want them to look out for the interests of consumers and of the public and of the environment and of agriculture. So they started a process about 10 years ago to revise their regulations. And then that happened a number of times. They started it and they stopped it each time. They put out a proposal. It didn't seem to please anybody. And they decided to go back to the drawing board. And they did that several times over that 10-year period. In 2019, the Trump administration, the White House, issued an executive order. An executive order is a policy, and pretty much what the White House said is they wanted all the three agencies to look at their current regulations and try to streamline them, try to make them more efficient, try to streamline them, try to reduce the regulatory burden. And again, in the abstract, I'm not sure I'm against that. You know, if it's done correctly, as long as we're still ensuring it's science-based. The executive order talked about things being science-based, as long as it's still ensuring safety for consumers and safety for the environment. And the executive order said that. But the question becomes, how are those being balanced? And so USDA, when the executive order came out, proposed a new rule that would radically change how they regulated genetically engineered plants. That rule was finalized in May of 2020. So they regulate them under the Plant Protection Act. And so they're concerned with whether those plants could be plant pests, could harm other plants. And that's a little bit of a hard sell on the science front. But that's the way they've regulated them historically. And so, as I mentioned before, in the past, you couldn't grow your genetically engineered plant in a field trial without getting a permit from the agency. And then if you wanted to sell it to farmers, well, if you have a genetically engineered corn and 100,000 farmers are going to grow it, you can't get 100,000 permits. So you would go to the agency and say, I'm going to petition you to deregulate my crop. I can prove to you that there are no plant pest risks associated with this crop. And so I'm going to say deregulate it. So that's what happened. And that was historically the way USDA regulated these things. The new rules that come into effect greatly change that. And they limit the universe of crops that will now be regulated. They've established a number of exemptions that they say if the crop meets one of these exemptions, they don't need to be regulated at all. Again, if those regulations are science-based, I'm not objecting to those, but I'm not sure the agency put a proper record together to show that they were science-based. But more importantly, they now said that you could self-determine those exemptions. So developers...
Self-determine. So, I mean, so who would be regulated can decide whether or not they're regulated?
Exactly. So they would decide, so you have an exemption category. And of course, and let me tell you, I mean, I'm sorry to get so much in the details and the weeds here, but it is a complicated process. But before this new rule, some genetically engineered plants were exempted, but it was on a case-by-case basis, and each one of them had to come to USDA under a process called an Am I Regulated process,
right,
provide data, and then the company and USDA would look at them and say, no, you don't have any plant pest concerns, you're not regulated. That was a process that the USDA was making the decision, and those determinations were made public.
Right.
Now, that process has been switched from USDA doing it to the company self-determining it themselves. And so a company can say, I looked at the regulations and I'm not regulated, but there's no check of USDA to see if they got it correct. And there's no public transparency about that. So somebody could put a newly genetically engineered crop now into the marketplace, and we wouldn't necessarily know it was out there. So
would they have to label it?
So we can get to labeling in a second, because I do want to come back to your what ended up happening under the law. But if that product got into food and fell within the bioengineered disclosure law, they would have to disclose it. The question is, how would people know to look for it if they don't know that it's out there?
Right.
Does that make sense? So, so whether it's disclosed or labeled is a question of a different law, and we can talk about that in a minute. But how do you comply with that other law if you don't know, if nobody tells you it's genetically engineered, if you don't have any record that it that the product that there's a genetically engineered mushroom out there? In other words, if a developer comes under the new rules and says, my genetically engineered mushroom can be exempt, it doesn't fall within any of the categories of regulation, I don't need to tell anybody about it. And then they start selling, and they sell it to the seeds to farmers, but they sell it just as a genetically improved mushroom variety. And they don't mention that it's a GMO.
So
you understand? And so then how does the food company know to label it or just disclose it if the farmer didn't know that they were growing it? You know, if you don't have the information and you don't even know to ask the question, if I'm Wegmans or I'm Walmart, why would I ask my farmer if he's growing a genetically engineered mushroom if I don't know if genetically engineered mushrooms are actually out there?
So what if that farmer was an organic farmer and he bought these genetically engineered mushrooms that he didn't know were genetically engineered mushrooms and was selling them as organic? Organic's not allowed to use genetic engineering. So, man, that seems like a mess, Greg.
That is, and that was one of the issues I pointed out in my blog article on this new rule, is that in fact, this what might make it harder for organic farmers and the organic industry to know which varieties not to purchase to comply. I don't think they would be in the end, that farmer you mentioned wouldn't be in violation of the law because they didn't know it was unintended. And so there's some flexibility in the organic standard for unintended. I mean, that product might have to be taken off the market once they found that out, but they wouldn't be, it would go to the credibility and the integrity of the organic industry if that happened on a regular basis.
So apparently, some people must have gone to the administration and said it'd be a good idea if we had less regulation and these are some steps we should take. And somebody in the administration communicated with the agencies and started working on preparing these rules and regulations, which ultimately have been put into place. And I assume that when they were written up, they were surely published, I suppose, in the Federal Register for people to comment on before they went into effect. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. So somebody thought it was a good idea. They got the administration to get it through the agencies. The agencies got the regulations out there, allowed a comment period, and then looked at all the comments and then said, okay, the way it's going to be, which is you would have to call it, I think, a deregulation when you create loopholes of this size.
So two things. I do think this is a deregulatory event, that the new rule captures a smaller subset of a smaller set of products than were currently captured. So in the past, the vast majority of genetically engineered plants were regulated by USDA in some fashion. Now a smaller subset is regulated. So clearly there are less products currently being regulated. So that is correct. And I would also point out that the regulatory system that we've used has always been I'll call it a scientific fiction. While we regulated them as potential plant pests, nobody ever really thought that they were potential plant pests or the vast majority of them. So in some ways, the new regulation is more science-based. It's actually more consistent with Congress's intent when they passed the law and the science out there. But what it does is leave a gaping hole of products that do have impacts, as I mentioned before, that now don't get regulated. And I think that's a product of the fact that we don't have a good law to address this technology and the products of this technology, less than about this particular rule, which actually is probably more science-based now in some ways than it was before. Remember that this is a very complex rule and regulatory process, and I've simplified a lot of things here in this podcast and in this short time period. So I think you have to, you know, keep that in mind. We are talking generalities, and there are a lot more details here, but the gist of it is that there will be less products regulated now than there were regulated before, and there'll be less transparency now than there were before. As to your comment about the public comment periods, there were public comment periods, and interestingly, on the issue I've mentioned, on the self-determination of the exemptions, there was actually a lot of not just consumer groups and environmental groups who opposed that self-determination, but there was actually a lot of industry who objected to that self-determination. And in fact, my organization, with a number of consumer groups, and the biotechnology innovation organization, the ones who the Monsantos and the Syngentas of the world belong to that organization, they also opposed the self-determination, as well as some of the grain handlers, the Cargills of the world, for some of the transparency reasons that I talked about. But the Trump administration did not meet our request.
Boy, that is incredible. So you really had a lot of the of this wasn't really driven by the big companies you would necessarily think of, because that was going to be my assumption. I brought that up, and I think a lot of people are suspicious of saying big companies are going to try to take shortcuts and don't want to be regulated, and so that would have been a lot of people's guess. But to have this get that much momentum without some of these major companies behind it, even if they thought it was a bad idea, that's pretty surprising.
Right. Now, again, there are lots of details in this rule. I'm not saying they were against all of those.
Sure, sure.
In particular, they did agree with CSPI that self-determination without a confirmation by USDA was not a good idea. And so they opposed that particular provision in the regulations, which was still kept in the finals.
You mentioned a while back that you could come back and talk about the implications to the labeling. So if...
Right. So I wanted to... So when we left our earlier part of the discussion, we mentioned that, you know, Congress passed the National Bioengineered Food Disclosure Law in 2016. That required USDA to come up with regulations and implement that law. They came up with regulations in 2018. And now that law is being implemented. And so as of early 2020, companies could start disclosing whether their products contain or don't contain bioengineered ingredients. And by January 1st of 2022, they will be required. Compliance will be mandatory in the sense that they will have to disclose whether foods that you buy in the supermarket have ingredients that came from a bioengineered crop or animal.
Right.
So if it's okay with you, I think it might be interesting for your listeners to understand how this rule works.
Sure.
And so the way the rule works is it's not a mandatory labeling law. It's a mandatory disclosure law. And let me make a distinction between labeling and disclosure. So the way the law does, it says the food manufacturer, so if you're buying cornflakes from Kellogg's, the food manufacturer is Kellogg's. If you're buying the Trader Joe's bran flakes, the manufacturer's Trader Joe's, is required to disclose if any of the ingredients in their food came from a bioengineered source. They can choose one of four disclosure methods. They can put text on the package, and USDA tells them what the text is in the regulations. That would be what we would consider labeling. They can also put a symbol. So you're familiar with the organic symbol? Well, USDA came up with a bioengineered symbol. And if this was not a podcast, I'd show you a picture of this bioengineered symbol. It's a round circle. It's green and yellow, and it says bioengineered in it. And you could put that on your food. That's the second option. The third option is you can use a QR code. So you can have an electronic code on your package that says, for more information, scan here. And a consumer would scan there. That would take them to a website. And on that website, that would where the bioengineered disclosure would occur. Or you can also say, for more information, text this number. And a consumer could text that number and they'll get back a text that says whether the food is bioengineered or not. So it's up to the manufacturer to choose the method they want to do. And so it's called disclosure because not necessarily everything will be labeled on the package. You may have to text or use a QR code or some electronic disclosure to get to the information. So that's what done. You've mentioned, I mentioned the word bioengineered, not GMOs. The law that Congress passed used the word bioengineered, and USDA told the manufacturers they have to use the word bioengineered. So you won't see a disclosure on the food that says genetically modified or GMO or genetically engineered. The only term it will be was, and so if there's text on the package, it'll either say this food is bioengineered or this food contains a bioengineered ingredient, or will have that symbol. They can't use the words genetically engineered or GMO on the food.
I really appreciate that explanation. Can I go back and connect this, though, to the implications of the areas that are being deregulated? So if some products are able to kind of slip through the cracks without really having to be regulated, then they're, in the way that we described it earlier, is the burden on the manufacturer or to be able to find out for sure that any of the products he's getting weren't bioengineered because they could slip through the cracks with the way that the system is getting modified?
So the next thing I was going to say, so the way that the rule works is USDA every year publishes a list of bioengineered foods. So there are currently 13 foods on the bioengineered list. And every year USDA will update that list. And in fact, they've just asked a request for comments if anybody has any foods that should be on that list. So that list currently includes corn, soybeans, canola, cotton, alfalfa, apples, eggplant, papaya, pineapple, potato, salmon, squash, and sugar beets. And so what USDA says is those are all the genetically engineered varieties. Those are all the genetic engineered crops or animals that have been marketed somewhere in the world. And you as a manufacturer now would know to ask if one of the ingredients in your food comes from soybeans or comes from potatoes, then you would ask whether that ingredient came from a genetically engineered variety of that. So the list sets the universe, and then the manufacturer's job is then to check to see whether their particular food and food ingredients have that either that food or an ingredient made from that food in their food, in the product they're purchasing. If the list doesn't have the mushroom on it from my earlier examples, then the manufacturer doesn't know to ask about the mushroom. So if USDA doesn't know what's out there and it doesn't make it on the list, then the manufacturer can't ask about it. Does that make sense?
That's the point I was trying to get in. So if you end up having mushrooms or whatever that aren't in those 13 that you just named, and they make it into the system, so a manufacturer is using it, but again, it's not on the list, they in fact could have been bioengineered. And I take your earlier point that they could be perfectly safe and most likely are, but still that for those that are concerned about knowing that fact, it would be, it's possible that it could.
Right. Now, again, in order to do this, you have to have the developer really attempt not to tell anybody, which likely wouldn't happen because the developer of the product wants to sell their seed at a premium and they want to say, you should buy our seed because it's special. And the genetic engineering makes it special because it has some better trait in it. So you could have a developer who says, I don't want to let people know for whatever reason. But hopefully, at some point, even if they didn't go through the USDA process, people would learn that this particular variety was genetically engineered. And so it would eventually make it on the list. But again, this ends up becoming, it ends up something, it's up to the developer. And the developer may have different motivations for doing, either keeping it secret or providing that information. It seems like USDA is not the one with the information. They're hoping, they're sort of in a position of maybe we get the information, maybe we don't.
Well, I would just say, though, in some cases, it's worth more for something to be organic than to be a GMO product in some buyers' minds. So it varies that whether or not there's a premium or an advantage to identify or not identify. And organics, usually you do get a premium.
Right.
But I want to come back to these rules and regulations again. Because now they exist, but in the future there will either be an election coming up. There'll be potentially new people hired in the regulatory agencies. No matter who wins these elections, rules like this. What's the process that they could be reconsidered? I mean, what's the process to say, okay, we put this one into effect? It did, in fact, deregulate, and perhaps we're learning that we went too far, or people feel we went too far. How likely is it that it can be reversed?
So I think that once something's in a regulation, you have to revise the regulation, you have to amend the regulation. That can be done, but it takes time. You know, you have to propose a revision, take public comment, finalize that revision. And I think there may be aspects of both the bioengineered disclosure law regulations, as well as the new USDA secure rule, that could, in a different administration, be revised. You also could have situations where the USDA rule that I talked about has this self-determination provision. It does allow for companies who want to come to USDA voluntarily and confirm those. And you could have just if you had a new Secretary of Agriculture who, you know, felt strongly that people should come and confirm those, that could be just sort of let out there, you know, through speeches and other things. And chances are most of the industry would want to do it because they'd want to stay on the good side of the new Secretary of Agriculture. So, you know, there are persuasive ways to achieve what you want to achieve without getting a regulation change in some cases. So we could see that on the secure rule. If you're talking about the bioengineered disclosure and some of the, you know, regulations there, chances are you'd have to change amend the regulations.
Well, it's an interesting issue, and I think at a time when people are suspicious of science and suspicious of regulation, and you know, there's not a lot of trust in society right now, I think that they need to hear some stories like you shared in this process, that in some cases these big companies that are very well invested in bioengineering weren't necessarily for having being deregulated. That I think that would be a news flash to a lot of people, that they just assume the companies are trying to go as far as they can, but that companies can say, wait a minute, no, there's a spot where we need to have fair and reasonable regulation, and perhaps we've gone too far in this way, and maybe you should regulate us a little bit more than you are currently.
I don't know how many of the companies would say they really want to be regulated more, but I think they are learning that transparency is very important out there, and that it for markets to keep the peace with the organic industry and others. And so they don't want no oversight at all. They want And I would say, you know, I'm not against deregulating products or exempting products. In fact, if there's a science basis for doing that, but we should have a good scientific basis for doing it, and we should be transparent about how we do that, and we should figure out if there's things we're going to be missing because they're exempt, such as information for the marketplace. We have to figure out other ways to get that information.
So, Greg, a little earlier, you were mentioning that there's really been no evidence that there should be reason for consumer health concerns. And I'm putting words in your mouth here. I can't remember exactly how you said it, but given that, and that if consumers want to know and be sure what it is they're consuming and understand about the process and whether or not there's, you know, the foods are bioengineered, kind of remind them again how they can find out. So if you're a concerned consumer and you want to know that process and you want to understand whether any of the foods were bioengineered, what is it again that they do to find out?
So I do want to clarify. What I said was the current crops that are currently grown, there's no evidence of any harm from food safety or nutritional differences those crops. So, I'm not making a pronouncement that all genetically engineered crops for the future will be that way. That's why we need to have them individually assessed
on a
case-by-case basis. So, but I can say that for the data we've seen and for the crops that are grown, they are safe. So you can, if you wanted to find out whether a food you're eating is bioengineered or genetically engineered or not, obviously one place to start would be the USDA website where they list these 13 crops and salmon that are out there in the marketplace. And so, you know, the first thing to do would be to look at your food that you're purchasing and see if they have ingredients that are made from those products. So if you're purchasing blueberries, well, there's no blueberries that are genetically engineered anywhere in the world. So all the blueberries you buy are not going to be genetically engineered. So you don't have to worry about that if that's a concern you have. And then eventually you'll have these disclosures, so you'll be able to know whether the products have an ingredient that is. Those won't, you know, be on every product until 2022. So you could call the company to ask them, the food manufacturer, if they used, you know, bioengineered corn in the corn oil that you purchased, and they might or might not be able to tell you that. There's no guarantee that they would be able to know that for certain.
Some companies have labels now, I believe, that they can look for a smart label of some sort.
And some companies, that's right, you could go to their websites and they'll list and they will tell you if they use bioengineering in any of their ingredients.
So, well, let me wrap up, Greg. It seems to me that there's been so much going on in these last few years. Genetic engineering, what was the GMO conversations, not been top of mind to many consumers. It's kind of gone, been other things that have been kind of crowding out on the news front. But if you look in this next couple of years, do you expect that the conversation will become kind of more public, that there will be other rules, recommendations, regulations? Do you think it's going to become higher profile or stay pretty much as it is right now?
I think, you know, what we haven't talked about today, we've really talked about more classic GMOs, genetically modified organisms, where we take a gene from one species and introduce it to another. But I think that, you know, what's being talked about these days is gene editing, which if CRISPR means anything to you,
sure.
And if you saw that the Nobel Prize for Chemistry was given to Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier for the discovery of CRISPR, that it allows you to edit genes. And so I think the big news these days is, how is that going to change agriculture? What kind of edits are we going to do? And in that case, you can introduce a gene from a different species in a very precise location, but you also can edit the genes already existing in a species to turn genes on or turn them off, to have them expressed more or less. And so I think that's the big area that people are thinking about could have some real benefits. And so the questions will be, how are those regulated? Are they regulated the same or not regulated the same at this point?
At this point, are they considered to be looked at as the same as far as USDA regulations are concerned? Is CRISPR get included in the broader regulation of bioengineering?
So I wish I could give you a simple answer to that. The answer is the definition that USDA uses for genetic engineering includes CRISPR and those gene editing. But then many of the exemptions that I talked about exempt many of those CRISPR applications. Not all of them, but many of them. So they are included in the coverage of the regulatory system. They're fit within the definition, but then they're exempted out, many of them. We haven't heard yet so much about what FDA and EPA will do on this front.
Well, Greg, there's a lot to consider there. And if people would like to see more on what in your own blog or other information, is there somewhere that they can go on your website to find what you've said about these issues before?
Yeah. So our website is www.cspinet.org. And then when they get to that website, there are two ways you can... the biotechnology project webpage is under Protecting Our Health. So they can click on Protecting Our Health and they go down and they see the biotechnology project. And then they can click on that and they'll get to the biotechnology webpage, which has my blog and a frequently asked questions pamphlet about this issue. They can also go to the resource library and put in the keyword biotechnology, and they can get things like comments that I've written to the agencies, testimony I've given on Capitol Hill at both the Senate and the House on issues like the disclosure law and where the regulatory system should go. So those are a few places where they can get additional information. The one other place I'll mention, the one other thing that's happened in the federal government recently is FDA has introduced its own website called Feed Your Mind, or it's a web page on their website that talks about genetically modified crops and talks about the safety of them and how they're used and which ones they are. It's a pretty good website. It does provide accurate information, and I think it simplifies the science so that non-scientists can understand it. It's not so easy to find, and I don't think most consumers will ever find it. But for somebody who really wants to look, that would be another place to get information about this technology and where it is in our food supply.
Well, it's a really interesting area, and you've done a great job of explaining what's a pretty complex area to most of us. I appreciate your taking the time to walk us through it, and thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Oh, no problem. Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.